Would that be a dream come true? Maybe, or maybe not. Monday's morning show begins just after 8.
Welcome to Civic Affairs, a program designed to promote good citizenship with a focus on how you can get more involved in the political process and in public administration. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, who has a Master of Science degree in journalism, and former Kenosha Alderman Steve Casey, owner of Casey Family Options Funerals and Cremations. And now, here's today's moderator.
Good morning. This is Len Iaquinta for Civic Affairs, and my guest today is Grant Pitts, who has been engaged in civic affairs through his work at UW Parkside and in the community. Good morning, Grant.
Morning, Len.
Grant, you just graduated this spring with some honors from Parkside, didn't you?
Yes, summa cum laude, and I was the recipient of the Chancellor's Award as well.
Now, what was your major?
Sociology, Bachelor of Arts.
So that's very relevant to our conversation of civic affairs, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say so, absolutely.
Now, I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about your civic engagement work at UW Parkside. I'm aware, and we did a program on community matters quite some time ago about this topic, and you were involved with a program that had some support from outside the campus for engaging particularly youth in elections and in the voting process and in general in civic engagement. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I got my start in civic engagement at UW Parkside through the Andrew Goodman Foundation. The Andrew Goodman Foundation has a project called Andrew Goodman Vote Everywhere, which has chapters, if you will, at universities across the country, which hire students to work as basically civic engagement ambassadors, whose mission is to get students involved in civic engagement, get students civically engaged. Sometimes that looks like raising the voting rate at a campus, but it can also include civil discourse and other means of civic engagement that are maybe a little more substantial.
What is civic discourse?
Yeah, civil discourse is something that I got exposed to almost through a happy accident in my work in the Andrew Goodman Foundation. My supervisor in that role, Deborah Karp, who was the director of the Community and Business Engagement Center there, picked up on this thing called Braver Angels. And Braver Angels is a national civil discourse organization that aims to bring together people from opposite sides of the political aisle to build relationships between them and find common ground. So civil discourse, for me, is really focused on that conversations across difference piece, but it can really include any conversation between any two people that has some political component or relates to civics in some kind of substantive way.
What kind of activities did you involve yourself in the promotion of this idea?
Of civil discourse?
And the voting part, too.
Many different activities. So we would very often at the University of Wisconsin Parkside have like a table on the campus concourse, get students registered to vote. That's kind of the entry-level way that an individual can participate in civic engagement, right? They can register to vote and then maybe pledge to vote. Also, we would often encourage students to pledge to vote as well. We would engage them in other ways, too. We had, at one point, a photo booth for people who participated in National Voter Registration Day. And then through Braver Angels, or in collaboration with Braver Angels, we hosted workshops, never had a debate on campus, but a number of our Andrew Goodman ambassadors were involved in that sort of civil discourse work as well.
What did you observe as you tried to bring people together for civil discourse? What did you learn from that process?
People are very easily able to build a relationship with someone that maybe before they participated in a civil discourse event, they never thought they would even like to talk to. We have more commonalities than differences overwhelmingly, and you will find an unlikely ally, let's say, and people who seem totally juxtaposed, you know, diametrically opposed to you, maybe politically. Maybe they come from a totally different culture, and you wouldn't think that you have any shared values. But if you sit down and talk to someone who is significantly different from you in any way, and including in their political leaning, you will find that on the majority of issues, you are probably aligned and you have a common interest, and it's very easy to build a relationship. The vast majority of people who participated in these experiences had a positive experience, met somebody new, and in many cases, someone that they maintained a relationship with after that experience.
Well, that's fascinating. Now, there must be guidelines for how to do civil discourse, whether it's over the Thanksgiving dinner table, or with your spouse, or your crazy uncle, or cousin, or in a more formally arranged civil discourse, and I know that Braver Angels does that.
Yeah.
How do you set that up to make it work?
Yeah, setting the intention and what we call the ground rules are really important for making that work. So anytime we would have a civil discourse event, we would preface that with a set of ground rules, which are, saying I instead of you, ensuring that you understand what the other person is actually saying before you choose to respond to them. So kind of repeating back what you have heard and your understanding of what someone else has just said to you to ensure that it's actually accurate. And just generally being respectful and curious. I almost want to say that is the most important one, because if you approach these conversations with genuine curiosity, the rest of these practices are going to kind of follow naturally.
I get it. We tend to have a tendency to be thinking about what we want to say next and not really listening to what the other folks are saying. And
yeah.
I'm as guilty of that as anyone, I suppose. That's a matter of self-discipline and I guess some training. How's that been working out for you as you observe it?
I think it works really well. I think people actually pick up on it very quickly. And that is one of the ground rules as well, is to listen more than you speak, at least in a group conversation setting, right? Some people do initially have difficulty with that, but over the course of a single conversation, almost everybody that I've ever engaged in one of these experiences has been able to adopt that practice and, really, really do it faithfully and listen with genuine curiosity to the person that they're talking to.
This is a technique that could be applied within a family or within a faith community or an educational community.
Absolutely.
Or any kind of organization, I suppose. What are your thoughts about that, and how can we employ this technique better? Because we are a very polarized country right now, and this seems like one of many options we could use to better understand each other and work common goal-oriented.
Yeah, the first thing I would say is that every single person should look for these experiences and intentionally engage in one wherever they're able to find it. And the second thing I would say as a follow-up to that is that not only should every single person in this nation and across the world intentionally seek out civil discourse experiences and engage with them, but also take the next step to become someone who can provide those experiences to someone who can facilitate an event, facilitate a conversation, moderate a debate, whatever it is, because that is how we really spread that culture, is by turning people into civil discourse advocates themselves.
Ah, that's very interesting. Now, Grant, you've done a lot of work. You were telling us about encouraging young people to register to vote and then to pledge to vote, which is very interesting to me. I wasn't aware of that. It's one thing to register. It's another thing to do it. And signing the pledge is a little bit of encouragement. What kind of results were you able to measure? I know that's difficult on a college campus, on a university campus like Parkside's. But what did you find out about working with youth in this way?
Yeah, our results, I would say, were pretty good. In the lead up to the 2024 election, we were able to engage over 1,000 students in person. We were able to reach every single student, either by text or, through text and university email system. A lot of those students took that step to register to vote, a decent percentage of them. I think, probably not as high of numbers as we want. We want 100% of them to take that next step, right? But a good percentage of them would register. It's a little bit harder to get them to pledge to vote, because that seems kind of abstract or, you know, intangible. If I'm registered, why do I have to take this other step? And, you know, what you really want, the most important thing, is to get that first foot in the door and get someone to actually register, right? Because, you know, if they don't register and they show up on election day with the intention to vote, they really may not be able to.
Well, that's very interesting. Now, what kind of objections did you get when you were working with young people? If you how did that pan out? It's interesting that you reached, sounds like 15 to 20% of the campus.
Oh, we reached more than 15 to 20% of the campus. We reached closer to a quarter, just in terms of in-person, face-to-face outreach in some form or other. this is something that really troubled me throughout the time that I did this work at the university, which was that there are a pretty large number of students there who feel very dejected about politics and very disenfranchised, and they feel that it is not worth their time and then it's ineffective, right? So that their vote doesn't matter. Genuinely, there are many people there who said, you know, I'm not wasting my time to register to vote because this system has not been serving me. This system has not been serving people like me. And this is not a good investment of my time. My voter registration and then my eventual voting, I don't think it's going to change anything.
That's pretty grim.
It is pretty grim.
We do not have 100% voter participation in this country, and I don't want to see it as enforced as it is in some totalitarian states, but we would like to see it a little higher than it is. What interventions did you try, or did you not really find anything that was successful in turning people around on that?
You know, I don't know that we really ever gathered any thorough information on whether people who previously didn't feel it was worth their time to register to vote and then proceed to vote were kind of converted by any of these practices, but we definitely found things that were effective in getting students to show up and register to vote. This is often said of events and how to make how to incentivize events that involve young people, which is just to make it fun, right? And we did a lot of that. We had, as I mentioned, for 2024 National Voter Registration Day photo booth, really nice photo booth that we brought in, had many students from across the campus take pictures. People really enjoyed that. People had fun with that. They, you know, approached us and engaged with us without us even asking them, right? Oftentimes when you're, you know, sitting out on a campus or canvassing, you really kind of have to pester people to get them to engage. But that certainly is not the case when you have something that is really attractive like that. Another thing that I can recall that was really effective was we had partnered with a local organization called Congregations United to Serve Humanity to do a poll simulation or a voting simulation, which is just exactly what it sounds like. We had some volunteers from the organization come in. We lent them a couple tables, and they set up a, you know, faux poll right there on the campus, right on the concourse, and, you know, students would come up and they would walk them through the process of voting so that it is less intimidating when they go to the polls and so that they understand what they are going to need in order to be prepared, from, you know, the greeter's table to the ward checker all the way to the chief elections inspector and actually putting the ballot in the box. And we were able to get a lot of participation in this by making it themed. The first time we did this was, I want to say, it must have been 2023, right after the Barbie movie had come out. So we did Barbie versus Ken election, and, you know, made it all pink and colorful. I dressed up as Ken. We had a couple of our ambassadors dress up as Barbies. I think we had another Ken as well, actually. And that was a really great event. We got pretty good engagement. You know, people were taking pictures and having a good time with it. Another thing that I've seen done, this is probably not as attractive an option, but it does work, is to make participation in some kind of civic engagement mandatory. If we're talking about in a classroom setting in a university, right, there is a fantastic program at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside called the Elections Experience, which seeks to engage students in a certain set of classes that are participating in this program in various types of civic engagement, anything from art projects to watching a debate to, you know, whatever else. There's a wide range of possible activities. And you are able to at least expose people to that in that way. They might not be particularly enthused about it, but that is, you know, just getting that exposure, you're going to hopefully interest some people who might not have otherwise engaged with civics in any meaningful sense. The most impactful way, though, by far, when you're able to do it, is to activate people on their self-interest or on their passion. Because really, again, just like with civil discourse, the end goal is not just to get somebody to engage with civics themselves, but to turn them into an advocate for civic engagement and into somebody who works to get others engaged with civics.
It's hard to make change in any system that you're within without participating in it and advocating and militating for that change. So this idea of working with youth to prepare them to vote, make it comfortable for them to vote, and to also learn how to discuss issues in a civil way amongst themselves and with others is very important. And we're talking about this, and the reason I'm wanting to devote time on this program to this is not really to feature Parkside, but to feature the methodology and the concepts, because they can be applied anywhere by anyone who has the motivation and the time to put that together. Our listeners might wonder, knowing me and my previous programs, why we're not talking about elections per se in this month of November, even though we didn't have one here in Wisconsin. And I just want you to know that we did make an effort to do that, but for some reason, neither the Wisconsin Election Committee nor the county clerk were able to provide a speaker to guide us and discuss that topic. But we'll return to that at another time, I hope. Grant, do you have any anecdotes you want to share with us that have come about during this experience? What did you anything that surprised you, or did you learn something that was or observe something that was just totally counterintuitive to what you would think and what so-called common sense wisdom would be?
Yeah, I would say that probably the most surprising thing to me was just that the number of students who didn't want to engage with voting and elections and civics in general, because we know that young voters can be and have been in the past, you know, one of the most impactful demographics in terms of swinging elections and getting them to go in ways that they might not otherwise have. This has happened numerous times here in Wisconsin. It happened in the 2022 midterms. And so these students have a lot of power, and they have a great self-interest in participating in civics because they're going to be around for a while. They're young people. And, you know, policy here in the United States has been really shifting very rapidly in the past decade here, and it's become impossible to ignore. So that was really surprising to me, just because I, as you know, a young person in a university setting, realized very early on that those things were very important, and that I couldn't ignore them. I mean, that's why initially I chose to do this civic engagement work, because it just felt necessary to me. So that attitude about it was very surprising. And the sort of culture almost of you know, apathy and disengagement that has arisen due to the disenfranchisement that people experience and due to the way that our systems don't serve them was very, very surprising.
It's interesting that you use the term disenfranchised, because it sounds to me like if you don't vote and participate, you're disenfranchising yourself.
Yeah.
But people don't feel that the franchise means anything to them.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, part of it is that there are genuinely a lot of real barriers to voting, especially from people who come from less privileged families, where maybe you know, their parents never talked about voting. So this is a foreign thing to them, never encouraged them to vote, who maybe don't have access to consistent transportation. This is certainly true of a lot of university students, right? Although, thankfully, at that particular university, at UW-Parkside, they do have a polling place on campus. But many places do not. And these, like, really simple things, even just lack of knowledge or lack of awareness of elections, particularly in the case of local elections, can disenfranchise people, you know, without their awareness, even. And though they may not be aware that they have sort of missed these opportunities in cases where it's due to a lack of knowledge, they still feel the effects of the disenfranchisement, because people are elected nonetheless, officials are elected nonetheless, and policy is passed nonetheless, and administration, you know, administrates nonetheless.
I wonder if we adults could, besides moaning about the apathy of young people, do something by setting an example, encouraging voting, and talking about our own experiences over our lifetimes, and sharing that with our siblings, with our young relatives. And parents have a role too, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I will say I heard some really fascinating stories from students, of course, but particularly from older people who maybe happened to be on campus while we were, you know, hosting these activities, and asked us what we were doing, and who related their experiences to us. These were people who were around during the civil rights era and remember how difficult it was for certain people to vote during that time, and remember just how the experience was different. I remember we had a gentleman come and talk to us once about his experience actually physically voting at the polls at you know, decades ago, when you had a machine ballot box or machine, a ballot machine, right, where you had to, like, crank the lever and you had, like, a curtain around you and this whole kind of thing. And at least, and maybe this is just because I'm a nerd for civic engagement, but I found that very interesting, and I would like to think that if people shared these experiences more broadly, that it would actually have that effect, right? And then maybe it would also have the effect of turning young people into not just civically engaged young people, but advocates for civic engagement.
Yes. I remember those machines, and I remember what it was like for people trying to vote in the 50s and the 60s. The voting machine was a ballot that was, like a wall in the machine, and you would put push a lever down to put your X against the person's name, and then when you were all finished, you'd pull this big master lever, and it would record all your votes. It was quite a contraption, but they were very accurate, and you couldn't hack them.
Mm.
Grant, I'd like to move on. Grant Pitts, you have been very active civically outside of the university. You're currently employed by Congregations United to Serve Humanity, which is an interfaith organization in Kenosha County that is primarily concerned with social justice issues, construed very broadly. I wonder what you have learned and what you have observed in participating in this kind of civic engagement. I wonder if you would just talk about it, because this is the other side of civic engagement. It's advocacy, it's exploration of issues, it's putting discussion groups together, it's doing research and discussing policies. Talk a little bit about that work, and how could people get involved in that work if they're not? And I would think that a young person who has a particular issue or a bone to pick with the current political system or the way they're being treated by it, this would be a way to attract people and get them involved. And once you get involved in that kind of advocacy, I doubt it must be hard to prevent somebody from voting after that experience.
Yeah, that is the hope. So Congregations United to Serve Humanity is a grassroots social justice organization. We do grassroots community organizing, and it has really my time at this organization changed my perspective on how to approach this work immensely, fundamentally. I wish I would have had the kind of organizing experience that I have now when I was a younger person doing civic engagement work at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, because it is really true that the best way to get somebody to vote and to participate in civics through those sort of formal channels is to engage them in advocacy and in social justice work, to find their self-interest, to build a relationship with people one-on-one, and to activate them around their passions. Once you get somebody to show up and volunteer, to go to a rally, to participate in a grassroots or direct lobbying campaign, something of this nature, they really easily understand the gravity of elections and of our political system and the importance of having good people in positions in our political system, and and very much the way that you suggested, they are much more likely to go on and vote because they are plugged into this. They are aware of the issues. They have been activated around their passions. They know what the consequences of elections are for the things that they care about, and they have an interest in involving other people. So that is really, I think, what I've been getting at when I say we want to turn young people not just into civically engaged people, but into advocates for civic engagement. A very experienced organizer who recently joined our network, Wisdom, here in Wisconsin, said to me that the main job of an organizer is to make other organizers. And I think that's very, very true and a really, really important thing to keep in mind for anybody who is working in this space. They talk a lot of times just in the nonprofit world in general about getting people on a ladder of engagement, a ladder of development. And that is really, really genuinely important, not just for an organization and the health of an organization or whatever concerns might lie there, but actually for the work. It is really important to get people to continually take the next step and become themselves leaders and advocates.
Grant, how can organizations of any kind be more welcoming of those wishing to get involved over an issue that creates a fire in their belly for change?
Yeah, my answer to that would be very similar. Build one-on-one relationships with people. I think this is something that a lot of civic engagement organizations overlook because of the way they approach this work. They're looking at it as a numbers game, right? They are maybe measuring the wrong things. They're asking how many people did we engage, did we talk to, how many people stopped by our table, how many people did we get to register to vote. But the thing that really ensures that someone is going to be invested in civics and really want to turn out to the polls is going to be building a real relationship with them, having a real conversation with them, activating them around their passions, making them aware of all of the various opportunities to get involved. Something like this is much more visceral than having somebody stop by a table you've got out somewhere, right, and register to vote. And that's great, and we need that. And it's good that we have that, but it needs to be married into a system, an organizing practice of building relationships with people and coordinating them, organizing them, if you will, towards civic engagement and for civic engagement.
This, in a way, circles back to our talk about conversations that are constructive civil dialogues, which means the organization has to be open and welcoming of difference and of young people's attitudes and how young people present themselves and look and dress. That is a little difficult for some of my older friends who are sadly more stuck in their ways than I would like them to be. If you're still listening to the music from the 60s, I think you ought to try something new. But that's easier said than done. Has your civic engagement ramped up quickly just since you've been going through this experience, your personal engagement?
Yeah, no? I would say the organizing work is really, really getting more intense now just with the progression of things in this nation. People are becoming increasingly more concerned about these issues just through osmosis by what they're hearing in the media, and then it's just much more intense for me now as well, because the longer I do this, the more it really becomes my vocation as opposed to my job.
That's terrific. My guest this morning on Civic Affairs has been Grant Pitts, and as always,